Welcome to Crypto Nights, where we help you finally make sense of the trending world of cryptocurrencies. So gather your virtual piggy bank and let's get started.
Hi, Bobo. How are you?
I'm great, Kant. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Why don't we start off with an introduction first to yourself and then to your company?
Sounds great. So I'm Mao. I'm COO and co-founder of Kora. And what we're trying to do is provide low-cost financial services to as many people as possible. And the way we're doing that is we're building our own blockchain, which, you know, I'm happy to go into detail in a little bit. And into that blockchain, we are embedding functionality for identity and for money transfer and for lending and cooperative financial services groups. And on top of that, so basically anyone that can access the blockchain can access all the functionality they would need to build their own financial infrastructure. On top of that, we're helping people access the blockchain without internet by going through telecom networks. So that's what we do. We have a beta coming up in Nigeria later this year. Well, later this month, really. Trying to bring low-cost financial services to people.
Where are you guys located?
So, you know, it's a funny question because we actually just had a team call with 12 people on it. So I live in New York. We are across 9 cities right now. We have staff in Houston, in Chicago, in London, Auckland, Dubai, Lviv, Hyderabad, and in Lagos, Nigeria. I think it's all of them. So we're pretty distributed.
Yeah, it's very interesting. That's why I asked. These days, I find that you're spread across not just multiple cities, but different continents. And so what is the backstory? How did you guys embark upon this idea? What is a typical classic use case that you guys started off with?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because me and my co-founder Dixon kind of approached this from different perspectives. You know, this is Dixon's third financial inclusion startup. You know, he's been doing this for a while. Previous two have been acquired by Chinese companies. For me, you know, I used to be a management consultant, but it really starts back when Occupy Wall Street was around. So I thought they had a really good point in the sense that a small amount of people are getting all the wealth. I just didn't feel like they had a coherent solution. So, you know, I kept kind of noodling at it. And back then I was in university, I was studying graphic design, ended up making a big pivot to financial services where I did, you know, two projects at Morgan Stanley and went to start my own AI company. And I kept kind of picking at this idea of how can we create more equitable distribution of wealth. And so I had been kind of figuring out ways to, you know, so-called bank the unbank. Then I met Dixon, who was working on the exact same thing, but coming from the other side. And so we met up, we had a great time. It helps that Dixon has a master's from a university in China, so we connected over that too. And, you know, ended up starting Kora a few months later.
How long has Kora been in existence?
The idea has been bouncing around our heads for a while, but we really started in April last year.
Wow, still you have been at it for almost 10 months now?
Which in crypto years is like a million years, right?
I know, that's what I'm thinking, right? So what in the last 10 months, what has happened so far?
Oh man, where to start? So I mean, obviously we started with nothing and here we have some things, right? We have 11 full-time people. We have 7 outsourced developers. We have a bunch of volunteers. We have an MVP. We have an Android app you can download on the Play Store today, as well as an SMS app. We're connecting with a USSD provider in Nigeria. We have a Node.js backend that connects with Testnet right now. We're building our own blockchain infrastructure, although that's quite a bit more complex. We have a deployment in Nigeria with 300 farmers. We're discussing deployments in Colombia around coffee, as well as Bangladesh, around a co-op, and you know a bunch of other ones that are lower profile, but are still quite interesting. I don't know. I mean, everything. We wrote a white paper. We started our ICO. A lot has happened.
Wow. And what was the, if you were to say, what is a canonical story or use case, the central use case, the most important use case that is behind Kora, what would that use case be?
You know, that's such an interesting question, Kant, because let me give you a few examples. Right now in Nigeria, we're helping farmers get paid. In Colombia, we would be helping, doing US to Colombia cross-border transfer from basically the branch and exporter. Then to the farmer, we'll be helping farmers with their accounting. In Bangladesh, we're helping a co-op bank with their core banking systems because they don't have everything's being done on paper. We've been in discussions with an impact investor in the UK to make loans to rickshaw drivers. We've had discussions with two large multinational organizations around grant programs. And so you were in like every different, all different geographies. In fact, I was having a great conversation on Telegram with a Serbian farmer who's also a Bitcoin miner. And he really grilled the hell out of me. He was like, how do you know this is really going to work? And he ended up giving us some great feedback on our white paper about like, you should really be thinking about these things when you talk about farming. And so we're in like all different geographies, all different use cases, but it really boils down to the same thing, which is around identity, around receiving payments, around increasing access, around lowering costs. You know, ultimately it's kind of the same thing. It's really around low cost access to financial services and greater transparency and greater ownership over your data.
So can we drill down just for a couple of minutes on each one of those, identity, receiving payments, access, and lowering costs? You gave me four key elements. Can you give us a couple of sentences in each of them? Like, how are you doing identity verification? How are they receiving payments and getting access? How are you lowering the cost?
Yeah, you know, I'll start from the last one. So access. Access is interesting because, you know, we kind of take for granted that you have internet, that you have a smartphone. I think there's a lot of the ICO products out there that talk about financial inclusion, and then it turns out you need a smartphone. Well, smartphones are expensive. You know, internet access is expensive. And so in many places where we deploy, we go through telecom networks. So anyone who could text or call is able to access financial services. So that's what we do for access. For lowering costs, what we're doing is because we're embedding, you know, functionality for identity and for money transfer into our blockchain, we're trying to create an efficient market around the IT costs of providing this infrastructure. Doesn't necessarily mean that you can lower the cost of money transfer or currency conversion or lending or lower the interest rate for lending. That is really more of a supply side issue where you really need to increase the overall capital supply and reduce credit risk and increase liquidity to really lower those costs, which we think bringing everyone into a global network can help with. You know, we also talked about identity. So identity is probably one of the trickiest things we've worked on because we're offering financial infrastructure. We need to give the users data privacy, you know, both because this is something they deserve as well as because we're usually required by law. But you also need to have the ability to audit data. And so with most public blockchains, you don't have any data privacy because everything's public. And then it's like something like Zcash, you don't have much auditability because everything's anonymous. On top of that, our users don't have internet. Our users don't have smartphones. So we're basically building this like multi-tier identity infrastructure where we were running a DPoS mainnet. And then on top of that, each user, so if I have like user one banks at bank A, user two banks at bank B, then we would start a small consensus round between these four entities running tendering consensus, which is quite fast to reach consensus on a state of a transaction. That payload would be essentially chained on to a distributed file system kept on a personal data server in a style not that far from Git. And then that would be kind of encrypted with their private key. So that's how each user maintains privacy over their data, as well as auditability, because the bank has a record audit trail for everything it goes through. And then the transaction hash gets put on the mainnet. And so if there's ever a dispute, they can just bust out their data as well as, which is signed by the private keys for each user, and match that to the transaction hash. So that's how we're dealing with identity. It's quite a bit complex. I think it's something that needs to be solved to really reach, you know, widespread financial inclusion.
Okay. Now, many of your so-called competitors might claim that they do many of these things, but I'm sure you started Quora because you found that this specific problem was not solved as well as you guys did. So what do you see as the key differentiators in what Quora offers vis-a-vis others?
You know, it's hard for me to speak to other blockchain products simply because there's not that much of a track record. I will give a shout out to Moeda. I think they're great. I mean, they operate in Brazil. We don't see banks as competitors either because we're serving people who are unbanked. So, and that's why I really think that we're in an area that's got no competition. If anything, our only competitor is really just the unit economics of deploying in that area. If we can make that profitable, then you know, what's stopping us? Everyone, it's not like anyone wants the farmers to be unbanked. And so I think that really our competitive advantage is trying to reduce the cost of this IT infrastructure and trying to use new technologies to make it easier to conduct KYC verification or make it easier to circulate digital currency within a small area while still retaining the ability to cash out cash. So I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question. Ultimately, it really is kind of a battle, or just working with the local conditions and trying to figure them out, more than competing against any other entity.
No, I think that's a very, very good answer. What you're saying is, you have found enough people that still have an outstanding problem. So you're saying, what the heck is competition? Because none of them seem to have solved the problem for these people. So you're being user or customer centric in the way you're designing your products, because they still have a problem no matter how many solutions are out there.
Yeah, this is a huge market and a lot of underserved people. And the other thing I'd say is that we're trying to be user centric, certainly. But even more than that, I think we're trying to be community centric, where we're trying to be respecting what are their traditions, what is their context, where is money being pulled? Is it being pulled like a community leader, in the church, in the co-op, individually? Those are the kind of parameters that we have to figure out to make our deployments a success.
And where are you guys headquartered as far as your ICO goes? What is your domicile, or which country are you guys going to run the ICO out of?
I am looking for a promising ICO. Look no further. At Cryptive, we are making cryptocurrency backed by stocks and bonds. We are creating an opportunity for people to invest in companies like Apple, Google, Amazon, straight from a crypto wallet. And 40% of our earnings will be shared with ICO participants every 3 months. Check for more information on our website, www.cryptive.io, and become our partner today.
We are domiciled in Hong Kong.
Okay.
And we're receiving accredited investors in the United States. We're blocking mainland Chinese and South Korean investors, although South Korea might change because it looks like the government's warming up there. And everyone else is covered under Reg S of U.S. security law.
I see. So you're based in Hong Kong, but you're working with accredited investors in U.S. and then blocking China and South Korea, but the rest of the world is fine, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. So for the U.S. investors, they have to do with their KYC and accredited investor qualification, or whatever you call it, before they can invest in.
We use a third party to basically look at our tax returns to make sure that they fill the criteria for a credit investor. So we actually don't touch their data. I don't think we want to.
Okay. Makes a lot of sense. And how does Quora make money in this whole process?
Yeah, that's an issue we struggled with for a long time, because the traditional way to make money, kind of Visa or MasterCard model, is you make this network and you perform a bunch of services for a network and you charge a network fee. And, that it is what it is. That's just not a model that appealed to us very much. It just seemed like, and it's kind of hard to defend as well, because it's like, if it's all open source, someone could just fork it and take out the network fee. So really where we've landed is, if we're going to make this, build this financial infrastructure for an underserved, community or underserved market, we just want to profit off providing financial services. So we're starting a separate entity that is getting licensed as a money transfer operator. And we're going to be essentially making money off, transferring money, as well as a few other businesses that we're thinking of adding on. So that's really, it's a very old fashioned kind of business model. It's one that's like ages old. So we're not really looking to profit off the network at all.
I see. And I didn't quite understand, where does money transfer come in when you're dealing with blockchain, or is that a separate piece altogether?
So let's talk a bit about cross-border money transfer, which is another incredibly complex issue. Mm-hmm. So, by the way, Khan, so how familiar are you with, do you regularly send remittances back? Do you like use any B2B payments?
Assume that, because I want to make sure that you give a ground level, kind of a basic description for a fourth grader type, because I want to make sure everybody in our audience can understand it.
Fair enough. So one of the most difficult parts of cross-border money transfer is really just getting licensed. So you need to have, so-called first mile and last mile. You need to be licensed in, your sending and receiving regions. And which blockchain network out there is licensed? you have some operators that plug into, let's say, they're, let's say, buying Bitcoin in one place and selling Bitcoin in another, and technically that's money transfer. And usually those operators are licensed, but you know, there's no network that can say, you know, anyone on this network can do cross-border money transfer inside regulatory frameworks. And so with what we're building there is really trying to be that, is really trying to provide almost like we're calling it like delegated liability, where we're providing coverage and we're ensuring compliance across this network and we're providing the service of cross-border money transfer. And besides that, you know, especially for many of the areas we serve where crypto exchanges are still quite young, there's limited liquidity if you really want to send large sums of money through. And so we're also building a multi-rail architecture which supports wires and traditional FX markets as well as crypto liquidity pools for, you know, cash out on either end when people are sending money cross-border. Does that make sense?
So you're saying primarily the money is being made in cross-border payments, but not on the network or the blockchain network you're building?
Yeah, we don't anticipate making any profit off the blockchain network. It's primarily off providing financial services like cross-border money transfer.
Wow. Are you a for-profit organization or a non-profit organization?
We're totally a for-profit organization.
Okay. But you want to keep the network free, but you want to figure out creative ways of making money elsewhere.
That is the idea. I mean, God knows if it'll work or not, but we just couldn't figure out a way to make money off the network.
Okay. Fair enough. I think that's a very honest answer.
Unless you do the consensus model where you just buy a bunch of some cryptocurrency and hope it goes up, but which we're kind of doing by default, but I mean, who knows if that's a viable model either.
Okay. So now let's talk about who should be interested in investing. You know, you're planning to do a token, you're planning to raise some money. Maybe let's talk about, can we talk about the ICO for a few minutes? How much money are you raising? Is there a soft cap? Is there a hard cap? What is the uses of the money you're planning to raise, etc.?
Yeah, so we're raising a hard cap of 24 million with a 3 million pre-sale, which we're pretty heavily oversubscribed for. I mean, use of funds is, the majority of use of funds is going towards R&D. Some of it will be going towards deployment and growing the network. And some of it just for administrative fees for the ICO. We're selling 45% of all tokens and retaining 20 for network growth and 20 reserved for recruiting people for R&D. And pre-sale starts on March 5th.
Wow, all the best. You guys are almost there. So the pre-sale itself is 3 million and the rest of it is in the regular token sale.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. And how long is the pre-token sale starting on March 5th?
So, I mean, it starts March 5th and it's supposed to end March 26th when the public sale starts. But I mean, in practice, it ends whenever it's filled up, and which may be sooner than 26th.
Yeah, usually is. And given the hot area that you guys are in, global, and I mean, the number of use cases seem to be so many. And you already started building a community in different countries, it looks like. So,
yeah, we got 3,500 people on English Telegram. We have a Korean Telegram, we have a Japanese Telegram. We have community managers in Brazil, obviously in Nigeria, Europe, and all the usual kind of, just trying to communicate with people wherever they're located.
Okay, that's fantastic. So you're raising 25 million and largely for R&D. I get it. So now, why should people buy your token?
I mean, I don't want to be like soliciting on the air, but what I'll say,
I'm talking about the utility and the value. You know, of course, number one, you have a limited number of tokens. I understand that part. And so I want to talk about supply and demand to some extent. We don't need to directly talk about the value. I understand the legal complexities behind that. So that's not my intent. I want to understand what are the reasons why there will be an increased demand. What is the fundamental utility that you will see happening in this, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe let's start with the first question. Why do you see the demand for this token going up in the next, let's say, 1 or 2 years?
Yeah. So, I mean, we were looking around and we were like, how are we going to build this? And I mean, it's abundantly clear that we can't build on Bitcoin or Ethereum. And you know, who else is out there? There aren't many platforms out there, maybe in like a few years, maybe. So the only, and on top of that, we didn't really see anyone with the same kind of focus on data privacy that we do. And like Monero and Dash were not really an option either. And so we kind of had to build our own blockchain to support the level of scale as well as data privacy. And so in order to get that level of scale, we're running a delegated proof of stake consensus algorithm. In fact, we're actually running the Ethereum virtual machine around Tendermint consensus and using DPoS to select validators. And so long story short, the token is used as a staking token. We are decentralizing the consensus by using the staking token so basically all the token holders would delegate their stake to block producers to select who gets the produced blocks. The top, N, in this case, probably going to be top 21 to start with, would be the ones who are in using Tendermint consensus to create blocks, and that takes like 2 seconds. And if they do a bad job or if they perform maliciously, then their collateral gets slashed, and obviously, hopefully, a new block producer gets elected. And so a token is used as a way to decentralize consensus for who becomes a block producer, as well as collateral for the block producers that put up. In return, token holders get a share of the block awards, and block producers obviously get block awards and transaction fees. And so, what we say is that when you're buying a token, the token's being used as a mechanism to secure the network. And it's also being used as gas inside the network. And then when you're buying a token, you're buying a share of the network. You're buying ownership in a network, or buying a stake in a network. So that's how we usually characterize what our token is doing.
Fantastic. Okay. So given the value proposition, I think you're looking for crypto savvy investors. You're not necessarily looking for people that are new to the crypto world. Your investor base is going to be largely within the crypto space.
We find that everyone's crypto savvy these days. But I mean, we don't really. It's funny because a lot of our investors actually come from the impact investing space. And they're fascinated by, the whole thing going on with crypto. And they want to put in some money to both for the mission and for, because they want some tokens. They want to have a piece of the network that we're building. So we're not too picky when it comes to investors. But we do find that in conversations with crypto with some more savvy investors, it becomes a little bit more clear in what ways we're differentiated against tokens that are, just an ERC-20 on Ethereum.
Awesome. Now let's say somebody is listening to this podcast and got intrigued and excited by what you said. What do you recommend as the next steps? Where do you recommend they go? What should they do? What are the next 2 or 3 steps you recommend?
Yeah, I'd say they should come to our website at Quora.network. They should join us at like t.me/Quora_network. They should join a whitelist. If they want to put in more than $50,000, they can just contact us directly at contributors@Quora.network, and we'll have a nice chat.
That's Quora.network, Network. Quora, Network, Network. Right? Mm-hmm. Did I get that right?
Yep.
So Quora.network. And you have the white paper there. I went through the video as well as the video is a very good place. I must say, Mama, your video is very easy to understand what your intention is behind this. And so are there any other interesting points that you wish to mention, or are there questions I should have asked that I did not?
I mean, I think we went through everything.
That's what I thought. So wonderful. I think I went through everything as well. Can you talk a little bit, maybe a couple of sentences about the team that you have put together? Because the team seems to be absolutely stellar. Can you talk a little bit about your couple of your team members?
This episode of Crypto Nights is sponsored by GoTenna Mesh. What is GoTenna Mesh? GoTenna Mesh, spelled GoTenna is GoTenna. Mesh, MESH, is a tiny but mighty device that pairs with any smartphone to enable the first 100% off-grid mobile long-range consumer-ready mesh network. Sends text messages, GPS locations immediately and automatically, privately one-on-one or to groups or as public shouts without any cell service, routers, towers, or satellites.
perfect to maintain connectivity and create a backup network when off-grid, exploring, traveling internationally, or emergency situations where power and consequently cell service is unreliable or unavailable. Gotenna and decentralization. Gotenna is a part of the movement towards decentralization. It takes the decentralization financial empowerment elements of cryptocurrency and applies them to communication, networking, survival, etc. How? It allows you to communicate with your smartphone without cell service, thus protecting you from spying eyes. All messages are end-to-end encrypted using public-private key encryption. With Gotenna, you can create your own decentralized network and be in control of the data that you create. It relies on people-powered connectivity. The more people join, the stronger it gets. Gotenna represents a unique blend. It mixes everyday consumer needs with the modern, more niche necessities of web-savvy users who rely on encryption to navigate our increasingly spying and risk-fraught communications technology. Much more reliable, effective than walkie-talkies and mobile apps. Example, FireChat, that allow you to communicate without cell service. Our reach is 50 miles at high elevations and 9 miles in most outdoor scenarios. You can take handheld encryption on the go. For this special unique promotion, please use the code CRYPTO35. That's Crypto35.
Yeah, we have an interesting team. So, you know, my co-founder, Cora CEO. This is his third financial inclusion startup. Previous two were acquired by Chinese investors. I come from a weird ass background. Before this, I worked in AI, and before that, I was a management consultant, and before that, I was a graphic designer. So I've done a few things. Our chief technical advisor, Eugene Fine, his team built out Ethermint, which is actually the protocol that we're forking, which implemented the EVM inside Tendermint Consensus. Our head of deployment was, he's been at a Nigerian NGO called Ifina for 4 years, which specializes in, agency banking and financial inclusion for that region. And other than that, we have three other experienced developers who are on our staff, as well as a fair amount of full-time outsourced developers. And the thing I'm really proud about for our team is that we actually have a fair amount of people that had zero crypto experience. We brought them in, and just through the process of doing research and fleshing out our platform, and one more thing we have in the works is that we got 4 more white papers we're writing, which is being written by the team. And so just in the process of doing all this analysis, they've become quite savvy at crypto. And I think we really designed some really innovative stuff that we haven't even shared with the community yet. But, So I'm quite proud of our team. We just had a team call. I think we're the only crypto project with a CFO, actually, maybe, on pro forma financial statements. Our head of product for cross-border money transfer worked at, built out the online brokering portion of a pretty large MTO and then left to start his own B2B payment startup. We have a pretty stellar bench of advisors. We have, for those that know stuff about money transfer, they almost always know the name Faisal Khan. Those that don't know about money transfer, no one knows him. We have John Edge, chairman of ID 2020. We have the vice chancellor of Covenant University, the Harvard of Africa, or so they call it. I like our team.
Awesome. When you were talking, I realized that if you have been at it for so many months, are you already funded traditional equity type of investment, or who put in the money so far? You have so many full timers.
Me and Dixon, we took money out of our pockets and put into a company.
Wow, true entrepreneurs, huh? Congratulations. I wish you the very best there. It's been absolutely a pleasure talking to an entrepreneur like you and your team. I wish you guys all the very best.
Thank you, Kant, you too. And thanks for taking the time to chat and having us on.
Thanks for listening to the Crypto Knights. Never miss an episode. Subscribe now at www.cryptonights.io.